and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, your host, and as always, I'm really glad you've decided to join us. Framing is everything. In our discussions, in our work, with friends, with colleagues, we're constantly drawing borders around conversations and particular events, rendering those things in greater context to convey a message, to express something. Nearly all of us do this. Lawyers, police officers, teachers, radio hosts. Our lives are drawn out by narrative, and narrative demands framing, particular borders. But this isn't just something that people do to tell stories through words. For many people, the world is best understood and shaped through images. Particularly at this time, a lot of people are experiencing and capturing people and places through images that move faster and are more available than ever before. Think of what you see each day on your Twitter feed or your Facebook. Salwan Georges is one of those people who's in charge of framing our world, so to speak. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who previously worked at the Detroit Free Press, and he's been trying to capture experiences, to tell stories, and to get people to bear witness to particular strands of truth that move about in our world. Lately, he's been in Ukraine, covering the war, and his images ask us some really compelling questions. What can happen in a particular frame? What kind of experiences can be told or shared? And what kind of truths and events can be expressed to onlookers? And, of course, what are the consequences of the answers to all of those questions? That's where we begin the conversation today, with the idea of images. What they tell us, what they teach us, how they make us feel, and in particular, how war images, images of conflict, of death, of aggression, elicit particular feelings from us about what's going on in the world. I'm really excited to welcome Salwan Georges to Detroit Today. Salwan, it is great to have you here.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, what has it been like on the ground in Ukraine? You've been covering people who have died, recently died, or are mourning. And I have to say, it's really intense just to see the work. So give us a sense of what you see day to day.
Of course. Well, what's happening in Ukraine during that time I spent there? I've been out of there for about three weeks to 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
This war wasn't like taking place on a battlefield. A lot of people lost their lives since the war started, and the Russians were bombing, you know, kindergartens, schools, hospitals, residential buildings, just simply people in line for their groceries, and which make the situation pretty dangerous and unpredictable.
Yeah. And when you're trying to tell this part of the story, talk about how that feels for you. I mean, this is the most intense part of these people's lives, the people in Ukraine who you're photographing. I can't imagine that it's easy to do that without having and feeling some emotional connection to the story.
Yes, of course. I try to kind of spend some time with the people before telling their stories to kind of, I mean, they're already going through one of their worst days in their life. And that's the last thing I want, is to add to that. So our job is to go spend time with people, getting them comfortable a little bit, and then telling their stories to the world. But, you know, sometimes it was hard to even talk to people because of like the suffering and the chaos that the Russian started causing the country from day one. You know, I remember I was in Kharkiv before the war. I kind of got a glimpse of the country before the war, which was like, you know, really beautiful country, really warm people. People, you know, like it was a normal day in any European country. Then the next day, the war totally changed. You know, sending people into shelters, underground shelters, sending them into, you know, trying to pack their car and get out of the country as fast as they can.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder what the reactions of the Ukrainian people are like. How are they enduring the war? Do they get accustomed to the idea that the war is taking place? Or is it constantly chaotic and disruptive in a way that that maybe they won't ever really be able to go back to quote-unquote normal?
You know, for Ukrainians, the war is not new. It depends also on the region. Like in the Donbas region, the war never stopped for the past 8 years. There was constantly shelling, like, and people, you know, losing their life. It never really stopped. So, but it definitely, people since 2014 have the idea of Russia at any minute could invade them. So the country kind of feel like it was ready, but people didn't really expect it to really happen. So a lot of people, you know, just put their uniform on, started volunteering at the, you know, territorial defense lines, and, you know, will give their life for their country. People were really resilient, kind of finding, you know, will fight for their country no matter what. And you got other people who, like, simply live in, like, farmland and live in the villages, just don't understand why this violence. It doesn't make no sense. They just, you know, trying to live their life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We've heard a lot about the Ukrainian people and their resolve to push back against the Russian invasion. There is a kind of scrappy tale, I think, that has emerged about ordinary people taking up arms or doing things that they thought would help push the Russians back. Give us a sense of what you've seen of that dynamic among Ukrainians.
I have seen from first day of the war long lines of, you know, people from age 18 to like 55, 60 even, waiting in line to get trained or to receive a weapon and be sent somewhere along the front lines or along a bridge or an entrance to a small city to protect their country. It was, you know, very, very obvious that, like, everybody was willing to give up their life to protect their country. I went to a couple trainings in different cities. People were training how to use guns. I talked to a few people, and one of them was a dance teacher, and she said she was planning to kind of leave the country, but then saw the attack started getting closer to her hometown of Odessa, which is in the south of Ukraine on the Black Sea, and decided to go get trained how to protect her city. And that, I heard that by so many people in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking with Salwan Georges, Pulitzer Prize winning photographer for The Washington Post. He's been covering the war in Ukraine through images. We want to hear from you during the conversation as well. What has it been like watching this war through video and photo images? What kind of impact is it having on you personally? And if you lived through other wars, like Afghanistan or Vietnam even, how does this feel in comparison in our social media age? We can see so much more of what's actually going on in Ukraine than we could in other places, and we can see a lot of it in almost real time. What does it feel like to be able to access images of this violence and destruction so quickly and easily? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page, put comments there, or go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation that way. Salwan, I wonder if this has changed the way you've interpreted war itself, and this war in particular, seeing it so up close. Do you see Russia and Ukraine and the West's role in all of this differently than before you went to be there on the ground?
For me, as a photographer, you know, I can't sometimes comment on things. You know, I try to kind of show everything through my camera, but you know, when I went through so many checkpoints, and when they heard the first days of the war, when they heard I'm American, they were like, "What are you doing here? Like, you should be, you know, out of the country in safety." And as we were driving against, you know, people were fleeing this side, we were driving the other side to kind of go to the front line and report on what was happening. But later on, you know, people are getting used to, you know, seeing a lot of Western journalists, a lot of, because, you know, I got there on February 14th, and I kind of got saw the country a little bit before the war. I've traveled through the Donbas region where it was actively hostile, and the war, a lot of people were getting shelled, and that's even before the war. So, you know, I mean, it's great that people kind of finally pay attention and trying to do something about the injustice and the evil of the war, because, you know, at the end of the day, the people are always the victim of any violence or any war. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what was happening in Ukraine, because, you know, I simply witnessed, like, we were around the corner, then all of a sudden they bombed a hotel, or they shelled a whole residential project, as we say here, buildings, where it sent many people living in their basement. Hmm. And I'm talking about early war. Like, now, there's been a lot of reports, we've seen so much, but early war, there was a lot of things that weren't being shared until we made our way there, until some of the media that were there got access to things.
Yeah, yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. You can also go to social media, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation. Let's start with Annette in Southfield. Annette, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. You may not like this, but here we go. My father taught me not to hate people, and I live with that quite well. Dad was 12 years old when World War II hit. He lived in Ukraine. He lived in a village called Kachilovka.
Hmm.
His family was murdered by his neighbors, the Ukrainians. He lived in the haystacks, in the barns. He lived underground. He stole from their cold storage potatoes, pickles, herring, and survived. Funny how no one really said much about people then, and they didn't save them so easily.
Hmm. So Annette, I'm really curious about what happened to your dad and the way he survived. Is part of the way he was able to share that story with you through images, or were there not images of what happened in Ukraine?
He said he described what had happened to him in stories on what had happened. There were no pictures, nothing like that. There was a couple picked him up when he was walking on the road. The father and said, "Let's sell him for a bag of salt. We'll trade him in. He's worth a bag of salt." The wife, good Christian, said, "No, no, we will not."
Hmm.
And they ended up feeding him a bowl of mush, which was nice. They took off his clothes and gave him holy clothes that were lice-ridden. and they let him out on the road, and he continued on his path. That was only one of his stories. I'm not trying to put down anybody in Ukraine. I'm hoping war will end altogether, there, anywhere in the world. Even though we, as the United States, seem to emphasize on that particular war over the war that's still occurring in Syria, the wars that are throughout Africa. It's amazing how we get stuck on one.
No question, Annette, that our attention goes to, places that we have particular interest in, and it doesn't go to others. Salwan, I wonder if you can talk about the choice to cover what's going on in Ukraine, but not in other parts of the world. I know that you're not, you don't run the Washington Post, but talk about the choices that are being made about how we cover this and how we cover, I guess, other things.
Well, I can speak for my experience and the Washington Post. I can't speak for any other media because that's not right. We have been everywhere. If you closely follow our coverage, we've covered almost every war, every conflict. I was actually, believe it or not, on a flight to Afghanistan to show the situation of the hunger and the really terrible situations happening there after we left the country when I got rerouted to Ukraine. So I've covered many conflicts in the U.S. across. Our job is always to be there. Sometimes some areas are not this accessible to journalists and dangerous, but we are still make our way there and risk our life every day to tell the story. My job is to kind of take photos and show what's happening in a lot of places. And that's the mission. And I know some wars don't get coverage as much. And that's because, the access and also some countries, like right now, I cannot just pick up my bags and go to Syria because, I'm not welcome there as an American journalist. So there's a lot of... there's a lot of logistic that goes through, like even in Ukraine, just like making choices that can basically save your life. If you take the road, if you end up in the wrong hand of if you end up in front of a Russian soldiers, they're not gonna welcome me. They're gonna probably shoot me. So there's a lot of limitations sometimes, but there's always a way to find to get to a place and cover it.
Yeah,
and tell us stories.
Annette, I really appreciate the call and the question. Let's go next to Anthony in Southwest Detroit. Anthony, what's on your mind?
Well, hi, good morning, Stephen. Real quick, I think I heard the photojournalist say he arrived in Ukraine on February 14th. Was that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you so much. But, he said the Washington Post, they've covered every war, but... that's kind of what I'd say the problem is, especially in Iraq. I mean, their coverage, especially if you look at their opinion section, it wasn't very very pleasant. But, and then the guest says right now, Afghanistan, I was taking pictures of the hunger when we left the country. Well, yeah, when we left the country, that's one thing that happened. What about the sanctions that we then placed on them and we froze their central bank assets? I mean, see, there's two sides of every story. Mm-hmm. So my question is, the guest said something we've never heard on your station until today that I'm aware of. That there's been 8 years of violence and shelling in Ukraine. So who was shelling who for 8 years?
So, Anthony, we've talked about this a number of times right here on this show, and that's all I have control over the content of here at WDET. And we've talked several times about the fact that this war is not new in Ukraine and that there have been tensions for a long time. There was a 2014 conflict there. That has kind of simmered in the background for a long time. We've had guests on the show who've talked about that. Of course, callers like yourself have mentioned it. So we have really tried to make an effort to talk about this in some context, right? It didn't just happen in February, but Salwan, I'll give you a chance to expand on this idea of the shelling that's gone on for 8 years, the conflict that's been going on between these two countries for a really long time.
Yeah, I'm from what I saw and from when I traveled to to the Donbas region. That was before the war started. Like a week or a few days before the war started, we visited some of those people living on the front line between, you know, the Donbas region, where some of it is it's not controlled by Ukraine, it's controlled by pro-Russian groups. And then they were basically, like, all these people said, we used to, like, you know, here and there get shelled, some people, you know, trying to cross and lose their life. But now it has increased to a point where we haven't seen that in the past 8 years, which is that kind of was indication that something bigger was coming, which is the invasion, of course. But we visited, like, kindergarten where, like, within, I think within, like, 30 minutes or an hour, they were able to move their kids and save a bunch of children's life because they hit a classroom in a kindergarten. I mean, that's all I could say. But the conflict definitely has been going on. If you read a little bit history of Ukraine, mm-hmm. you kind of could see that happening. And I'm no expert because, you know, I'm a photographer and I go and show what's happening and report back and show the world the situation on the ground.
Yeah, yeah. Salwan, I want to really thank you for coming on with us. I also want to note that, again, that you were really great as a Detroit Free Press photographer, which is
which is
where you and I met years ago. Did you always imagine that when you were here, for instance, did you always imagine that you would go off to cover wars and do all of these things that are really much different than your work here in Detroit with the Post?
I mean, actually, being from Iraq, that kind of interest was always there for me, where, like, I kind of lived through the war and I couldn't really tell it through my images because I wasn't a photographer back then. I was just fleeing with my family as a refugee and then making it to Detroit. Like many immigrants, we have a great immigrant community in Michigan. And then, you know, I always had a passion for photography and storytelling. And I've always wanted to tell stories where can kind of help some people and also raise awareness of situations. And that's a lot of the work I do at the Washington Post. I've traveled to almost every continent other than, of course, Antarctica and told stories and try to raise awareness. Like, if you look at, you know, child slavery in Africa with chocolate, simply stuff that people forget about. There's a lot of conflicts. There's a lot of stories to be told. And I feel like at the Washington Post, we try to be there and raise awareness.
Yeah. Okay. Salwan George, is great to have you here with us, and great work documenting the war in Ukraine. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, we're going to continue this conversation about images. We're going to talk about how social media has had an impact on the war in Ukraine with Assistant Professor Jen Schrady, who is author of the book, The Revolution That Wasn't, How Digital Activism Favors Conservatives. Really interesting conversation about how images are shaping our opinion of the world. Stay with us for more Detroit Today.
Bringing you news that matters.
Stories that impact your life.
Music from the Motor City and around the world.
This is 101.9 WDET.
Detroit's NPR station.
This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson. And as always, thanks for tuning in. The TikTok war. That's how some people have come to describe Russia's war on Ukraine, implying that it is a war that is playing out on our social media as much as anywhere else. And if you're like me, images from that country have just been pouring onto your screen now for several months. From the breathtaking work of professional photographers like Salwan Georges, who we were just speaking to citizen journalists who are gathering visual evidence to archive what some are calling war crimes in that country. Aside from the shock or absolute horror of seeing these moments play out in real time, I really wonder what larger role these pictures are playing in our lives, especially when it comes to depictions of war like we're seeing in Ukraine. It's not that we should look away or ignore what's happening, but I wonder how much exposure inspires engagement outside of these platforms. How many of us are moved to do something, for instance, by the images that we're seeing of what's happening in Ukraine? And the flip side of that question is whether overexposure to these kinds of images leads to a more passive form of thinking about all of these things. In other words, do we just get used to the idea of shocking, disturbing images and kind of recoil into a space where we're not really as motivated to do everything? This is not just a question about war images either. If you think about the place that we live here in Southeast Michigan, city of Detroit in particular, think of the really horrific things that happen to our fellow Detroiters and how often we hear about those things or see images that remind us of those things. Does it make us numb to the idea that things can change? Or does it inspire us to actual activism? Or is it kind of a mix of those two? Jen Schrady is a sociologist who teaches at the Paris Institute of Political Science, and she studies the role that social media plays in social movements. She joins us now to continue the conversation about the power of images here on Detroit Today. Jen Schrady, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you so much for having me. You know, I grew up in Northwest Ohio, right on the Michigan border. So grew up listening to WDET. So I'm thrilled to be with you today.
Yeah, no, it's really great to have you with us. You recently published an article in the Washington Post, and it critiqued this idea of referring to Ukraine's war as the TikTok war. You said, quote, "Today's social media posts represent more evolution in communication than revolution." So I want you to expand on that and talk about how this war is influenced, I guess, by our interactions on social media and I guess how it isn't.
Absolutely. The role of social media right now with what we're seeing in Ukraine, or as you mentioned, images of protests or other social injustices in Detroit, for example, are really critical to what's happening in those events, and obviously clearly important to what's in front of our screens throughout the day. But, you know, we've had over the last few decades a lot of claims of, for example, the Arab Spring or Occupy Wall Street were Twitter revolutions or Facebook revolutions. And the latest is, right, that what's happening in Ukraine is a TikTok war. But if we go back even further and think about the role of visual images, they, for the last century or more, they've always been really critical to how we view major events. If we think about, you know, kind of the grim images that many of us saw during the Vietnam War through TV media, or, you know, for those of us who are old enough to remember those kind of indelible images of the Berlin Wall being smashed and seeing those as well. You know, so they are important. On the other hand, they're just not enough to really sustain any kind of social or political movement or even support for people who are fighting a crisis like those in Ukraine.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk specifically about Ukraine and what's going on there with social media. You have a lot of Ukrainians who are using social media to try to aid their fight back against the Russians, and of course to draw attention to what's going on there, to inspire others to help that movement. So, in your estimate, how is that going? Are they experiencing some success in doing that? And then talk about how this moment, I guess, is different from what we've seen with other conflicts. I mean, I feel like even in the last 5 to 7 years, social media has evolved so fast and to such a different place that what they're doing in Ukraine might not even have been possible in other conflicts. So I wonder what you make of what they're doing and I guess what it means.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I will say that unlike those images broadcast through Vietnam or, you know, other wars, as you mentioned, what is different is that we are seeing a lot more images from people on the ground. However, I don't want to over, kind of sell this idea that anyone, individuals, images can go viral. I think that's kind of the myth that that anyone's photo or video can go viral. Certainly it can happen, but what's more common is your discussion earlier around photojournalism, traditional media, people who have training and resources to really have images put out there over the long term are much more commonly seen. But it's not only people on the ground who are affected by the war. Certainly many of us have seen those. But I think what's really telling is clearly the role that Ukrainian President Zelensky has played in this whole concept of a so-called TikTok war, right? Of course, his experience as a TV personality himself and really understanding what is effective and persuasive visually has only helped his cause and the cause of the Ukrainian people. On the other hand, you also mentioned that, you know, the more recent way in which people have been able to really use these tools, even 10 or 15 years ago, showing videos instantaneously was very challenging, right? That kind of technology is very recent. At the same time, right, we have other wars that have been happening, whether, you know, with Syrians or Ethiopians that have had smartphones and have filmed and tried to upload their videos, but they didn't always, you know, have the same level of widespread support, really, and sympathy as Ukrainians have. And a lot of that is based on ways in which race and racism may play a role. On the other hand, I think that the positive element in this is to really see how key these digital tools are, but at the same time, how limited they are. Because as you mentioned, you know, this was a few months ago and Ukrainian war really dominated headlines. And it's still part of the news cycle. But unfortunately, the other downside of something like a so-called TikTok war is that it's often then framed as, unfortunately, a form of entertainment, right? And people get tired of it. And that's why the role of professional journalists are so important, to really maintain that kind of coverage in a regular news cycle.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking with Jen Schrady, who is a professor and author of the book, The Revolution That Wasn't, How Digital Activism Favors Conservatives. She writes about how social media affects social movements. We're talking about the war in Ukraine, the images that we're seeing from that country, especially on social media, and how they influence the way we're thinking about that conflict and maybe the activism that we're inspired to because of it, or the sense of ubiquity, perhaps, that we come to accept of violent images about what's going on in the world. We'd love to hear from you during the conversation as well. What do you make of how war gets depicted on social media? Does it make you feel more engaged in what's going on in Ukraine to be able to see exactly what's happening during the war? Does this ease of access to images and video clips make you feel more informed about what's actually happening in Ukraine? Or on the flip side, does it dilute the gravity of the moment for you? Do you find yourself gripped by the images, but not moved to the kind of action, I suppose, that that might be inspired by these images? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page and put comments there. You can go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation. I want to go back to that point that you were just making, Jen, and talk more about this role of professional journalists in this time, and I guess the work that's being done alongside, maybe, is the best description. The differences that you're trying to highlight there, I think it's lost on some people why that's important. Why does it matter that somebody like Salwan Georges is in Ukraine to document what's happening there? Why is it, I guess, important in a different way from what Ukrainians themselves are documenting, or other people who are there on the ground who aren't professional journalists, who are sharing what's happening through their social media?
Yeah, I mean, I think the other key element that photojournalists really bring to the table is being tied to news institutions, media outlets, where you can have more context to those images. Hmm. I mean, I love TikTok. I love, you know, seeing how news is flowing through various social media feeds, and you know, the trite way of saying, you know, a picture is worth a thousand words. Of course, that's true. There's a lot of emotion that images can provide, but, you know, photojournalists really, again, in the way that they are tied to news institutions, can provide a much deeper context that the written word or an on-air reporter can supplement with that. That's just really hard to get in a 280 character tweet or a 3-minute TikTok video. And, you know, there was this fantasy, you know, 15 years ago or so, when people started using those terms, citizen journalists, that, you know, we no longer needed mainstream media, and, you know, traditional journalists would just disappear. But I think now more than ever, with all the conflicts that are happening, is that they're even more important when that attention does start fading, that we have institutions that are tied to really presenting this information, because that's something that I've really found in my research, that digital activists in particular, who, you know, are really able to sustain high levels of digital engagement, are part of movements that are organized, that are resourced, that have a division of labor, really, in the digital element. And if we just rely on individuals, that's really not going to happen, right? We're not really going to be able to sustain our ability to engage with social justice injustices around the world.
Yeah. Okay, coming up, we're going to continue this conversation about images and social media and the influence they have over the way we think about things like the war in Ukraine. We'll come back to your calls and your social media comments. If you want to join the conversation, 313-577-1019. Call and tell us what social media is telling you What is it inspiring from you with regard to events like the war in Ukraine? Is it something that you're counting on at these days? Or is it the kind of thing that you think floods the zone, so to speak, and makes you kind of inured to the idea that this is so horrible? 313-577-1019 is the number on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page or to Twitter and put comments there. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. Listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. We have been talking this hour about the power and influence of images, and in particular, images right now that we're talking about on social media, the influence they have over our thinking about events like the war in the Ukraine. We also were talking about the power of the professional photography that we're seeing emerge from journalists in Ukraine who are documenting the war. Our guest right now is Jen Schrady, who's a professor and author of the book, The Revolution That Wasn't, How Digital Activism Favors Conservatives. She writes about how social media affects social movements. That's what we want to hear about from you as well. What role is social media playing in your understanding of what's happening in Ukraine? And what's the, I guess, emotional response you have to the constant flow of images from the war there that we can see on Twitter or on Facebook or on TikTok or Instagram? Does it inspire you to take action? Does it inspire you to feel like you are part of a movement to stop the war in Ukraine? Or does it become, or does it have kind of a dulling effect, I guess, over time that that you see so much of it that you don't react as viscerally as you might? As always, the number on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page, put comments there. Go to Twitter and hashtag us, and we'll include you in the conversation that way. Let's start with Brad in Rochester Hills. Brad, what's on your mind?
Hey, Steve. It's great to hear from you. I don't use any – I don't view any social media on the internet. I don't even have a TV yet. And I do listen to what's broadcast about the war in Ukraine by different radio newscasts. Where I get my news from, and it helps me to the best kind of action I take forward, so I don't have to be dulled too much, is pray on a daily basis for the Ukrainian people, especially for President Zelensky.
So, Brad, I wonder if you can talk just a little bit more about your social media use and why you have chosen to opt out of that. I think that's a really interesting dynamic. It's unusual, right, in our modern culture. But what is it about social media that is not attractive to you?
And have access to it, like some of my neighbors do. I'm an old school guy that gets just information, as I just mentioned, off the radio. Whether it's one of the newscasts like Morning Edition or All Things Considered from NPR or off of WWJ News Radio 950.
Yeah. Brad, I'm glad you called and shared that. I mean, I think that's a really interesting way to exist in the world right now, and it's a pretty bold choice, I think, because of the kind of social pressure that I think all of us feel, from social media. The idea that, well, everybody's there, I should be there too. Everyone's getting this information, I want it too. Jen, this idea of withdrawing from social media and getting information through other sources is quite interesting. It would give you a different view of the world, I would imagine, a very different view than most people have.
You know, Stephen, I think it's critical, not only people who are choosing not to engage with social media, but the digital divide is still very strong in the United States. And we're not just talking about access, which is key and still very important, which the pandemic certainly showed very clearly. But it's regular, consistent access. It's high-speed internet. It's having skills, understanding how to use a vast array of these tools, right? So I've been trying to figure out TikTok myself and uploading videos. Before I went back to academia, I was a documentary filmmaker for years, and I have some of these general skills, but it still takes time to understand all of the different nuances of this vast array of social media platforms. And these types of digital inequalities not only affect how people are consuming digital content, but also who the producers are, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the findings in my research is that not only is there a very clear social class divide, that people with more resources and power and more elites are the ones that tend to post more content, especially political content. But the other challenge is that over time, far-right conservative groups also end up dominating online. So we end up having an ideological gap as well. Yeah. You know, there was this, you know, very utopian idea that the internet would create this very egalitarian space where everyone could participate online. But that's not the case at all. And that's key to remember when we think about what's happening in Ukraine and the images that we're seeing. We're certainly people on the ground facing what's happening with Russia's attack, but also the level of disinformation that's coming from Russia to the point where people, you know, are questioning what they are seeing and fearing even sharing content, worried that it might be some type of disinformation. So that's the other real danger of imagining that we have this kind of utopian TikTok war right now.
Yeah, yeah. Again, Brad, really appreciate the call. And that's a really fascinating way to be navigating the world right now. Let's go to Phyllis and Warren. Phyllis, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Stephen. I'm in quite agreement with the idea that too much is more than enough. I do not have any social media contacts or any programs that I'm involved in. I listen to the radio. Mm. I listen to NPR. I listen to WDET, or I listen to the University of Michigan, or I might just pick up a station from someplace else. I think there is too much information out there. You get enough, it fills you up, and you're done. You're ready for tomorrow. That's not good enough. That isn't the way we get things done. Mm. I've been through the Second World War. I've been through the Korean War and all these other conflicts that we'd have up until now. That doesn't help us. We have to talk to each other. We have to live with each other. We have to respect each other. Yeah. And that's the only way we get things done. Yeah. We don't get it done through pictures on a little box that lights up.
Phyllis, I really appreciate that perspective. I'm glad you, really glad you called Jen Trady. Talk about, I think what she's getting at there is the damage that social media does to interpersonal interaction, which I think there's no question that's taking place. I've only got about a minute left, but I want to give you a chance to respond.
Absolutely. I think Phyllis and Brad are both raising these critical issues of how we, you know, those of us who are academics or journalists tend to rely way too much on what's happening on Twitter or hashtags, but so many people are getting their news from TV, from the radio, et cetera. And there's this really big news and digital media ecosystem. And it's really important to understand that broad sensibility, not only in terms of whose voices are we hearing and who are we reaching on social media and who are we not reaching, but also, as you mentioned, will we just be not only overwhelmed with these digital images, but to the point of, you know, it's simply a drug, right? Mm-hmm. That we just want more and more of that adrenaline hit. and eventually it overwhelms us, or we move on to the next hit, right? The next catastrophe. And that really doesn't benefit anyone.
Yeah. Jen Trady, it was really great to have you here with us on Detroit Today. Thanks so much for joining.
Thank you.
It's going to do it for us today. Come back tomorrow when I'm going to talk with Natasha T. Miller about her book, Butcher. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.